We have a weird homicide.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
The police released their only suspect in the mass murder of film star Sharon Tate and four others.
Late last night, another bizarre murder in Los Angeles, the second in 2 days. The owner of a small supermarket chain found in his home, his head covered by a white hood, a meat fork stuck in his chest. His wife, 38-year-old Mrs. Lino LaBianca, found in the bedroom dead, her back brutally cut by a whip.
He's inside, two bodies outside.
They came and went, and the number varied from 20 to 30. Police said they were a pseudo-religious cult. People who worked on the ranch said they were heavy users of drugs.
Were lurid. The movie actress was Sharon Tate, 26. The others were a male hairdresser, the heiress to a coffee fortune, a writer, and a boy just out of high school.
A wandering band of members of a so-called religious cult with a leader they call Jesus has had three of its followers arrested in the investigation of the murder of Sharon Tate and six others. Those arrested are two women and one man, and the Los Angeles police said they would ask murder indictments against several others. Five women are being held as material witnesses.
They called themselves the family.
Los Angeles has had another multiple murder. Last night, a middle-aged couple was stabbed to death in a case that has striking similarities to the mass murder Saturday of actress Sharon Tate and four friends.
Only taking dope and stealing cars and they just sit around all day and sleep, and that's about it. And went around collecting garbage and had that for dinner and went to the store once in a while, and that was about it. They just slept and got loaded.
People who lived with Manson on the ranch and in the desert denied that they were a violent group. They called themselves the family.
Who's playing? That's what the whole thing is, that all we was doing out there was playing.
Well, what kind of guy was Charlie?
He's a good person. A very good person. He's got a lot of peace.
Was he out there all the time?
I don't even know. You know, he'd take off over mountains, just like deer.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
On his body, the word war had been carved in the chest. Then, with blood, the killer had scrawled on the refrigerator door the words, death to pigs.
Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Todd, and I'd like to thank you for joining me again as we prepare to take our seventh look at Charles Manson and his family. Before we get into the story this week, as always, I have show notes. If you would like to follow me on any social media, that would be Facebook, Instagram, MeWe, YouTube, Twitter. You can search for either Ian Totten, author, The Deathcast, or Corpse Creek Publishing. If you'd like to sign up for the show's mailing list or just drop us a line, let us know how you think we're doing, you can go to corpsecreekpublishing.com, click on the sign up button or the contact us button. While there, please consider making a donation to the show by clicking on the donate now button. Buy me a cup of coffee or a pack of smokes. If you really enjoy what I'm doing, there's a couple ways you can help out there. Go to wherever it is you find your favorite podcasts and leave a 5-star review, as well as subscribe. Lastly, if you are interested in helping with the production of this show, you can go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon for as little as $2 a month. You can sign up, become a patron of the show. Lastly, it was brought to my attention that the third episode in this series concerning Charles Miles Manson and his upbringing, there was something wrong with it, and for some reason another show got uploaded in its place. I am working to correct that, but as of right now, it appears as though I am going to have to record the entire episode, so please stay tuned. I will be getting that out as soon as possible. Alright, now that all of the plugs and other show notes are out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, the Manson family had just committed the Sharon Tate, Jay Sebring murders at Cielo Drive. The following morning, this would be August 9th, people within Benedict Canyon noted that they had heard screams and possibly a few gunshots the previous evening. However, since this was LA, this was not seen as being out of the ordinary. Between 4:30 and 5 a.m., a delivery man brought a copy of the Los Angeles Times up to the Polanski household on Cielo Drive and noticed that there was a wire down that was draped across the fence. At roughly 7:30, a neighbor of the property walked out to get his own newspaper and noticed the wire down. He also noted that there was a light on the garage up at the house. The housekeeper for the Polanskis, Winifred Chapman, who was running late that morning, arrived at the Cielo Drive house at around 8:30 a.m. When she attempted to gain access through the gate, she noticed that there was a wire down. Also, that the newspaper, the Los Angeles Times, had not yet been collected that morning. After getting through the electronic gate, and with newspaper in hand, she went up to the garage and turned off the yellow bug light that was on the front of it, after which she circled around the house to a side entrance that was used for servants. After this, she went into the kitchen, placed her pocketbook down, then Winifred picked up the phone for some reason, only to discover that it was dead. She also turned out the back porch lights. After this, she went into the dining room and from there walked out into the front of the house where she spotted streamer trunks sitting out, a towel, as well as blood spots on the floor before finding Frankowski's body, along with the front door to the house standing wide open. At this point, Chapman turned around and ran screaming from the house back out the entrance she had used and down the hill. After trying one house, Winifred went to the Asim residence, where she encountered a 15-year-old by the name of Jim Asim. She stated to the young man that there were bodies and blood all over the place up at the Cielo Drive house and that the police needed to be called. Apparently, it took 3 phone calls before the Asim boy was able to get police to respond to the call, which is odd when you consider the fact that he's obviously telling them that there's a woman at his home screaming that there are bodies up at the house of her employer. Apparently, the police did not take this phone call, at least the first 2, seriously enough to respond, to the point that a 3rd one was placed, at which point they sent out officers to investigate. That's one of those things that I will chalk up to the fact that this was Los Angeles in the 1960s. There was a fairly large crime rate, but there was also a lot of prank calls and things of that nature, and I would imagine that the dispatcher believed that the 15-year-old who was placing the call was probably playing some kind of a prank. At any rate, at 9:14 a.m., 2 officers driving separate cars received a dispatch, quote, code 2, possible homicide, 150 Cielo Drive. Officer J.J. DeRosa arrived first, at which point he encountered Jim Assam and the housekeeper, who told him about the blood that was all over the house and the body that she had seen, while showing him how to access the gate. Upon gaining access to the property, DeRosa saw the body of Stephen Parent slumped in his car with the motor and lights off. As he was checking on Parent, another vehicle arrived carrying Officer W.T. Wisenhunt. This point, the officers called for an ambulance, stating that they did indeed have a homicide, before proceeding up the hill to the house proper. Both men were carrying rifles as they reached the Cielo Drive house. As they later testified, both officers first checked the second story of the garage before going back down to the ground level and passing Sebring's black Porsche, after which they headed across the lawn where they encountered the body of Wojtek Frykowski and almost immediately saw the body of Abigail Folger lying to the south. Somewhere during all of this, another officer named Burbridge arrived, and he joined the two other policemen as they stood in the front yard, just gobsmacked by what they have encountered. They have a body down in a car on the driveway. Now they have two bodies in the front yard. One thing that has never been clarified is how the housekeeper missed the two bodies that were lying in the front yard, or that of Stephen Parent out in his own vehicle. The officers could see that there was blood all over the front porch and that the front door was open. You can imagine the horror they must have been feeling as they tried to take all of this in. You know, initially they thought these were prank calls, but now that they're on the scene, they have at least three definite homicides with no idea of how many more there might be inside. While Officer DeRosa covered the two men, Wisenhunt and Burnbridge decided to go around to the back of the house to see if they could see anything. And they were discovered that the back door was locked. It was at this point that they noticed the window screen that had been slashed and then removed, and the two officers decided to enter through this. The reason stated later was they had no idea what they were going to encounter once they entered the house, and they feared that the killer and or killers might still be inside. There are some people who question why the officers went in through this window as opposed to using the front door, which was obviously open. Some people like to spin this as part of the, you know, conspiracy theory surrounding these murders. Anybody who knows police procedure, however, will tell you that officers will oftentimes look for an alternate route of entrance as opposed to simply walking in the front door. All you have to do is look at SWAT teams and groups of that nature who look to sneak inside of a house when they are attempting to apprehend or neutralize a suspect, to know that this is how things are done. And obviously, the officers are, you know, terrified and upset by what they're seeing. They still had the wherewithal, however, to understand that we can't just go flying in through this front door, you know, with guns a-blazing, because we don't know what we're going to find once we go in. After the officers had made their way inside, DeRosa saw them walking through the house. It was at this point that he went over to the front porch and noticed the word pig scrawled on the front door in blood. It was at this point that he himself entered the house, and the bodies of Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring were discovered in the living room with the rope still wrapped around their necks. After discovering the bodies, the three officers quickly searched the house and ascertained that there was no one left inside, be they living or otherwise. They then went about the arduous task of attempting to secure the scene. It was after searching the remainder of the house that they exited it and began to make their way towards the back half of the property, at which point they heard barking dogs as well as the sound of a male voice coming from the guest house. Inside, a young man by the name of Billy Garrettson was telling the dogs to quiet down. There were at least two Weimaraners inside. Garrettson had been asleep on the couch, and the barking dogs, obviously alerted to the presence of the police officers, had woken him up. As he stood, the young man noticed an officer pointing a rifle at him from out in the yard, and this was quickly followed by another officer. At this point, Officer DeRosa kicked in the door and was promptly bit in the thigh by one of the Weimaraners. Garrettson was roughly thrown to the ground and placed in handcuffs. All the while, Garrettson was asking the officers, "What's going on? What's the matter? What's the matter?" The officers, obviously believing that Garrettson was involved in the slaying, dragged him over to the house, at which point they showed him the body of Abigail Folger. The young man believed initially that the body belonged to that of the maid until he was shown Frykowski's corpse, after which they brought him down to the car where Stephen Parent's body was still lying, and he was unable to identify the victim. Somehow, Garrettson ended up down at the front gate and was surprised to discover that Chapman, the maid, was still alive. If you'll remember a moment ago, I stated that he initially believed that Abigail Folger's corpse was that of Miss Chapman. Chapman, being as confused as the young man, informed him that the body that he had seen was in fact that of Sharon Tate. At this point, both Chapman and Garrettson were taken to the police station by DeRosa and Wisenhunt, leaving Officer Burbridge behind to protect the integrity of the crime scene. With Miss Chapman eventually being taken to UCLA Medical Center for sedation, after which she was returned to the police station for questioning. Naturally, the media, who are known particularly in Los Angeles to monitor police radio bands for anything salacious that might be going on, heard that something had happened at Cielo Drive, and immediately they began calling around. There were rumors floating that a fire had taken place in Benedict Canyon, which had killed five people, one of whom was Jay Sebring. One of these reporters ended up calling Sebring's home and was met by an employee who was working at the home. The employee informed the reporter that they had no idea what was going on. After this, the employee called the vice president of Sebring International, who in turn called Sharon Tate's mother, who in turn attempted to make contact with Cielo Drive, where her daughter was living. According to Miss Tate in a later statement, the phone appeared from her end to be ringing. And Miss Tate, hearing the phone ringing on her end, decided that in all probability her daughter had decided to spend the evening with her friend Sheila Wells. So all of this is going on, and police descend en masse on Cielo Drive, with helicopters flying overhead, taking photographs of the scene far below. Again, reporters learned of what was going on and were quick to rush to the area, clogging the roundabout at the bottom of the hill, making it difficult for both emergency services personnel as well as police officers to both ingress and egress out of the estate. One of the first superior officers to arrive gave a statement to reporters stating, quote, "All of the beds, including those in the guest house, appear to have been used. It looked like a battlefield up there." And it was in this fashion, with the officers coming and going, that it was learned that murders had taken place up at the house. One officer stated that the murders appeared to have been ritualistic, which, if you listen to the opening of the show, would turn up in newscasts and in print media in the subsequent days and weeks after the crimes were committed. Later commentators would state that officers had, in fact, given out too much information to the reporters. Again, anybody who is familiar with homicides is aware that officers and departments will hold back key bits of information from the media and the public in the hopes that they can later use it to link a suspect to the crime. In this case, because it was such a sensationalistic murder, the officers didn't hold anything back, and in fact were just giving all of the information that they were gleaming away to the reporters. Some quotes that came from officers concerning the murders are as follows: that the victims were in, quote, hippie-type clothing, that one of the victims had their pants down, that it appeared that some sort of orgy had been going on, and, quote, a typical fag murder. Somehow in all of this, it became something of lore that Jay Sebring was found with a black hood of some description over his head, and this in turn gave rise to rumors that there was a sadomasochistic orgy going on up at the house, and that apparently it had gone bad. Reality is that Sebring had a brown towel tossed over his head after being murdered. The police went about processing the crime scene. It's estimated that anywhere from 40 to 60 officers and other emergency services personnel were on the grounds at any one time. Eventually, at roughly 10 a.m., one of the officers called Sharon Tate's mother, although I have not seen anything stating that she was informed at this point in time that her daughter had been murdered. But it was through Sharon's mother that the officers were able to get the name of William Tennant, who was Sharon's business manager. Tennant was located eventually at a tennis club, and he arrived at Cielo Drive roughly around noon, still dressed in his tennis-playing garb. Tennant is the one who identified the bodies before quickly departing. It has been said that Tennant was sobbing profusely and, by his own admission, attempting to hold back from vomiting. Upon reaching the throng of reporters at the base of the driveway, Tennant fought his way through them, refusing to comment in any way, shape, or form. It was through Tennant that Roman Polanski would learn of the fate of his wife.
From Ian Totten, best-selling author, The House of Silver Doors, The Blood Gods Trilogy, Maggie. A book which New York Times best-selling author Keith Elliott Greenberg has called a classic detective story, well-crafted, and a supernatural vortex. Maggie, the name was burned into Lieutenant Carl Jablonski's mind like a brand, and had been since the night of the fire. He doubted he would ever forget that night, or how she had danced in the flames of her burning home. Maggie, who was she, and why did no one in Kaya's Crossing seem interested in talking about her or her family? These were questions without answers. Quandaries that drove Carl on as he explored the darkest of the town's secrets, desperate to unravel the knots that tied everything together. Maggie, Carl felt haunted by a visage, even as the local reporter, George Murphy, told him of the blood-soaked history that lay along their path, and the horrors that it held. None of it seemed real, and yet it was. The sacrifices, the screams, the pact with the nameless ones, and the hell that she had endured. Maggie, hers was a crime begging to be solved, and he and George are the only ones with enough heart to do it. The real question is, will they survive long enough to do it? Maggie, available 11/30/2021 in paperback and hardcover. E-book pre-orders are now available at Amazon.com. Only from Corpse Creek Publishing. You have been warned.
When he was reached in London, it was early evening, and at first Polanski believed the Tennant was playing a joke on him and hung up on the agent. And according to Tennant, when he called back, Polanski repeatedly stated over and over again she was, quote, such a good person. Roughly 10 a.m., this was before Tennant actually arrived on scene, the West Los Angeles Police Department arrived and took over the investigation, with one officer covering the body with sheets. You may have seen these photographs online. They're pretty famous. Initially, the officers were running on two theories: A, that this may have been a revenge killing, or B, that this was possibly a robbery gone wrong. And they operated under these beliefs for some period of time. While this was going on, another officer gathered up all of the knives and other sharp implements within the house to see if they could find blood on them, as well as taking a .45 caliber revolver, which had been a gift to Roman Polanski by those who worked on Rosemary's Baby with him. Also taken in the search were the broken pieces from the handgun that had been used to bash various members of the household. They also went to Folger and Frykowski's home at 2774 Woodstock Road and confiscated address books, notes books, personal papers, and a box of miscellaneous photographs and negatives. between 10 and 11 a.m., a repairman from the telephone company arrived on scene and repaired the wires, thus allowing the police to communicate with both the precinct and other aspects of the investigation. One piece of information that's interesting to note is that the police were curious as to what might have cut the wires, and being so curious, the actual section that was cut down from the telephone poles was removed and taken into police custody. At least 43 blood samples were taken from within the house, all from different locations. This was used to create later a large blood splatter map that was presented at trial to show just how vicious and atrocious the attacks had been. One thing of note, though, is that not all of this blood splatter could be attributed to the killers and the actual commission of the crime, as the scene was so gruesome, officers invariably tracked blood in and out of the house and into other areas of the home where no actual assaults took place. One piece of evidence that has never been fully explained is a boot heel print out on the flagstone front porch that was made by neither the police nor the perpetrators. Why this bit of information is perplexing to so many is there's a lot of speculation and, in fact, some evidence that Manson or others may have visited the Cielo Drive home after the commission of the murders to either hide evidence or rearrange the bodies in some fashion. This being done for whatever reasons the particular teller of the tale wants to put forth, be it that they were attempting to conceal the quote-unquote true perpetrators of the crime or pin the murders on the family, or in the case of Manson, to try and send a much more chilling and grisly message. Fingerprints began to be dusted for and lifted at roughly 12 p.m. Eventually, they walked out with at least 50 sets of fingerprints, with 22 being eliminated and 3 that were unmakeable. The remaining 25 were unidentified. Initially, a good portion of these were found on the window frame of the nursery where Tex Watson and later the officers entered. Some of these were eventually connected to the perpetrators of the murders. Something else of note, and quite unusual in a crime of this magnitude, is that the chief medical examiner for LA County, Thomas Noguchi, ordered that the bodies not be disturbed until he and his assistants were able to arrive at the scene and process them. Once Noguchi arrived on scene, the ropes that had been placed around Jay and Sharon's necks were cut from the ceiling, as well as to separate the two bodies. Later, these pieces of rope would be cut into sections in an effort to trace where the rope may have come from. We're going to get into some real specific stuff here at this period of time, and this is just stuff I find fascinating. Not everyone is aware of what actually happens when bodies are discovered and they have to be processed. Firstly, clean sheets, usually from the medical examiner's office, are placed over the bodies after they have been examined by the medical examiner's office. The reason they use sheets from the medical examiner's office is, generally speaking, these are sterile sheets, not thought to contain any sort of contaminants that might later lead investigators down a wrong path. So that was a misstep on the part of the Los Angeles County Police Department, in that they, one of the officers put sheets over the bodies before the medical examiner arrived. However, it's understandable in some regards why this was done. A, the officers didn't want to look at the bodies while they waited for the ME to arrive. And B, I would imagine that the individual who put the sheets over the bodies decided to do so in an effort to help the bodies remain free of any contaminants that might be kicked up by those who were investigating the scene. The medical examiner, after arriving and inspecting the bodies, had bags placed over the hands. This is done to ensure that anything that might be on the hands that could be evidentiary remains. That could be anything from skin cells underneath their fingernails in case they have scratched their killers, to defensive wounds or clumps of hair should they have been able to get a hold of their killer's hair and pull out some of it. It's to keep everything that's on the hands from transferring elsewhere. After this was done, the locations of the bodies yet again photographed and measurements taken. The bodies were removed from the house via ambulance. Something that came out much later is that while all of this was going on, obviously word is leaking out of the murders. Friends of Jay Sebring went over to his home prior to police arriving to search it and removed any contraband that was there. In this case, contraband is obviously drugs. After which the officers arrived at the home and began looking for any sort of evidence that might lead them to who the killers could be. Police ended up bringing out a fairly large truckload of evidence from the Cielo Drive home, which was brought to headquarters for examination. A pair of glasses had initially been found in the foyer next to the streamer trunks, which belonged to Sharon as she was planning to travel. Police picked them up and placed them back on the sideboard, and eventually they would be given to Sharon's father, Paul Tate, who spent several unsuccessful weeks attempting to locate who they might belong to. At the house, police found a half-filled bag of marijuana that contains 26 grams, along with hashish, 10 MDA capsules, cocaine, and marijuana. Later, they would also discover some home video recordings that we will get into shortly. But these home video recordings are important in one regard, as many have stated that these were actually films that Polanski had made of orgies wherein his wife Sharon was forced to have sex with African-American men against her will, as well as some pretty horrifically brutal rapes that Polanski is alleged to have possibly videotaped. Again, that is all speculation. I don't know if any of that is true, but that is a story that has been floating around for over 50 years at this point. It is, however, known that police did in fact find some sort of personal videotapes connected to Polanski and that they later returned them. At police headquarters, William Garrettson was questioned by police at 4 p.m. Police noted that he gave stuporous and non-responsive answers to pertinent questions. After the interview, Garrettson secured a lawyer for himself, which police almost always immediately think of as a sign of guilt, i.e., this person's not guilty, why is he lawyering up? Well, it's pretty simple why he was lawyering up. You never talk to the police. I don't care what happened. You can talk to any former cop or private investigator. They'll all tell you the exact same thing. You never talk to the police. You get a lawyer. And then if you have to talk to the police, you talk to them from that point on. And this is done to protect yourself, as the police have a way of twisting statements that people have said to implicate the individual, but also police have a way of ganging up on individuals and forcing false confessions from them. So again, if you're ever in a situation like this, don't talk to the police, get a lawyer. Have the lawyer talk to the police, and then if they absolutely have to talk to you, they can do it with your lawyer present. Anyway, when Garrettson was questioned a second time, he was a little more forthcoming with things as his lawyer was present, and he eventually agreed to undergo a polygraph examination on the following day, August 10th, with his lawyer being present. The police basically locked down the house for the next 2 weeks. In all of this rush, the body of Stephen Parent was initially forgotten about. Again, you have a Hollywood starlet, for lack of a better term, a very famous hairstylist and a known drug dealer, and Abigail Folger, all found murdered. One enterprising reporter was able to get the license plate number from the vehicle that Parent had been driving, and it was through this that he was able to find out who the individual was. Eventually, a family friend who was also a priest identified Steve's body. While parents learned of their son's death through media reporting. The Sharon Tate murder really had a ripple effect on Hollywood, as many within it began to question as to whether or not they might not be next. Media has really blown up the Tate-LaBianca murders into something they were not originally. Yes, there was shock throughout Hollywood, but it wasn't a countrywide thing as has been portrayed in the media in the decades since. It really was confined to Los Angeles, particularly to those within the entertainment community. They were the ones who were shocked and aghast at this crime. But once it got picked up by media outlets and started getting transmitted across the country, that is when it took on this frenzied tone, which is still evident in the reporting of it to this day. The average person was not terrified that they might be next, and they weren't, you know, completely bowled over and devastated by these murders, as has been portrayed. I've read and seen some documentaries where, much like the hippie movement, they act as though the murders in Los Angeles just absolutely had a devastating effect on the country as a whole, and it was all anybody was talking about. That is not the case. It did not become the case until after the murders had been committed and the media got a hold of it and really started building it up into something more than it actually was. And that is really important to note, because the shock and awe that was felt, again, really was just felt within Hollywood. The stars and producers and everyone else within that bubble didn't know if somebody was targeting them or if somebody who was in the entertainment industry had a grudge against other individuals in the entertainment industry and had decided to target them. So the stars and everyone else were terrified of what, you know, is going to happen, because even though she wasn't a major movie star and no amount of reporting will ever change that fact, Sharon Tate was a star of some level. Her husband was quickly becoming a world-renowned director, and the sheer brutality of her murder, along with those who were in the house on Cielo Drive, made it a big deal, but not as big a deal as it was to become. There are some of you who might be scratching your head trying to grasp what it is I'm saying. So, we're not covering it this week, the LaBianca murders, but when they do happen, on the day that Sharon and Sebring and etc.'s bodies are discovered, the police in Los Angeles did not initially connect the two murders. Violent crimes of this type were pretty common in Los Angeles. And while the murders of Sharon Tate, Jay Sebring, and company did make national and even, to a lesser degree, international headlines, it wasn't until the two crimes were connected that the Tate-LaBianca murders began to become what it is we know today, which is this, you know, horrific crime that every man, woman, and child walking the face of the earth with access to, you know, some form of entertainment or the internet knows about. The Tate murder, when it happened, it wasn't a lead-off story that people in New York City were going to see on their local newscast. It was later on in the program when the LaBiancas were murdered that night and discovered the next day. It didn't lead off national news again, because this kind of stuff, unfortunately, happened and continues to happen all of the time in Los Angeles. As for the Tate family themselves, apparently and understandably, when Doris Tate learned of her daughter's murder, she was devastated and is quoted as having said, "My God, Sharon's been murdered. My baby's dead." While her father, who was on base up in San Francisco, took a different tack and actually flew down to Los Angeles, where he rented a car. He arrived at Cielo Drive late in the afternoon and got no further than the gate, at which point the police stopped him from proceeding, not even allowing him to view the only remaining body, that of Jay Sebring, which was in the process of being loaded into the back of an ambulance. From this point on, Paul Tate, who is a known intelligence asset in the Army, begins his own investigation into who had murdered his daughter, something that we will cover later in another episode. As the friends of Sharon began to learn of her murder, many of them were understandably shocked and devastated. I have read reports where a few of them had initially suspected that Roman may have been involved in Sharon's slaying, being reminded of, A, how dominating he was of her, but also of his absolute desire to not be a father. I don't believe these particular reports, but that's just my opinion in that regard. Whatever else you want to say about the man, from the first time I ever heard of these crimes, I never once thought that Polanski was involved in the murder of his bride, because Sharon was something of an ornament to him, a trophy wife, if you will. Back in London, it was roughly 7 p.m. when Bill Tennant called Polanski the first time and called again afterwards. And according to Polanski's assistant, Andy Bronsberg, I handed the phone to Polanski and he literally unraveled in front of my eyes. He disintegrated. He put the phone down without hanging it up, rushed into his bedroom, and was weeping and crying and banging his head against the wall. Polanski had been planning, or so he says, to return to the United States to finish working on the script for Day of the Dolphin, but also to possibly be there for the birth of he and Sharon's son. More on that in a moment. At this point, though, however, Polanski literally pulls no stops in order to get back to Los Angeles. Understandable, his wife has just been murdered. He wants to get back there and find out what's going on. One interesting thing of note, again connected to the my opinion BS theory that he had had something to do with it, people were talking in whispers that there was a possibility that Roman had done this because he had learned that he was not in fact the actual biological father, and that it was Jay Sebring who was the father of Sharon's baby. This goes back to the fact that he and Sharon, he being Jay Sebring, pronouns, pal, had been engaged to be married and had continued their friendship even after she spurned him for Polanski. A lot of people believed that Sharon and Sebring were continuing a romantic partnership even though she was pregnant and married to Polanski. My personal opinion is I believe that there probably was some sort of trysts going on between Jay and Sharon even after her marriage. However, I do not believe, again, that Polanski had anything to do with the murders. As for the parentage of the child, there is every possibility that it was Polanski, just as there's every possibility that Sebring or any number of other individuals with whom Sharon had sexual relations prior to becoming pregnant could have been the father. Mind you, this is Hollywood. These people, even though they're married, monotony is not generally in their repertoire, and the reality is it's known, it's out there that Sharon did have other lovers beyond her husband, and the stories are out there that some of these lovers were caught on tape by her husband, and in fact he encouraged this type of behavior. As the investigation moved into its second day on August 10th, the bodies of those slain at Cielo Drive were autopsied, with Dr. Noguchi performing the autopsy on Sharon Tate himself. Noguchi is the man who autopsied both Robert Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe. Members of the LAPD Homicide Division were on hand during the autopsies. It was during these autopsies that members of the Sheriff's Homicide Department, Paul Whitley and Detective Charles Gunther, approached those who were working the Tate murder and informed them that there were similarities between the slayings at Cielo Drive and the murder of Gary Hinman. These being the words written in blood, the use of knives, etc., etc. Should be noted that the LAPD homicide detectives considered the information they were being presented with as not being connected to their own crime. On Sunday, August 10th, mind you, this is the day after the bodies were discovered, a press conference was held during which Lieutenant Robert Helder announced that efforts were being focused on trying to discover who the perpetrators were, and at the present time, they were focusing on acquaintances of the caretaker, William Garrettson, who, if you will remember, was the man who was arrested inside of the guest house. The reason being for this is that the officers were not entirely satisfied with Garrettson's answers, even though later in the afternoon, Garrettson did submit to a polygraph test at which his lawyer was present. It was noted that Garrettson was stuporous and vague, as if he were under the influence of some type of narcotic. It was also noted that Garrettson seemed confused and was unable to remember key events from the day and evening of the murders. Quote Garrison, "And so I stayed home all Friday, August 8th, and I cleaned up the house a little bit and did the dishes and everything. And they came around 8:30, 9 o'clock, somewhere around that time, and I went to get something to eat, and I went down on the strip. I had something down there, and I could see her light all the way down from Cielo, not Cielo, but Benedict Canyon, all the way down to the strip." What he is talking about here is that somebody had arrived at the house prior to him going out to get something to eat, and Garrettson could not remember who this individual was or what the purpose of their visit was. He's also stating that while he was down on the strip getting food, he could see lights up in the canyon. Garrettson never, to the best of my knowledge, clarified who the they he was talking about was. He also was unable to give a really concise answer as to what he had been doing during the actual time of the murders. I know during trial he stated that he was writing a letter to a friend named Daryl while listening to The Doors and a Mama Cass Elliott album. Although, during his polygraph, he stated that he may have gone out behind the house. Despite all of this, however, it was found during the polygraph that he was truthful in regards to his answers concerning any involvement he may have had with the murders. Garrettson's lawyer ended up securing the services of a PI who put Garrettson through another polygraph examination. This investigator later stated that he believed Garrettson probably had heard something that night, although whether it was due to fear or drug usage, he was unable or unwilling to admit to this fact. Interesting of note is that later on, Patricia Cronwinkle would admit to having entered the caretaker's house and finding nobody there, which begs the question, where exactly was Garrettson at this time? It very well possibly that he was hiding behind the house because he did hear what was going on there. It's also possible that he was getting high somewhere and was in fact not actually on the property. The owner of the home, Rudy Altabelli, arrived back in Los Angeles on that Sunday evening, August 10th. And obviously, since he could not go to his own home, he actually went and hung out with Terry Melcher at his Malibu Beach house. He was interviewed by police as early speculation was that the individual who Polanski had thrown out of the house during the March party may have been responsible. Police were speculating that the word pig, which had been written on the door by Susan Atkins, was in fact Pick, which was the name of the man who had been thrown out of the party. So later, Altobelli would claim that he initially thought that Manson was probably responsible for the crimes when he was coming back from Europe to the United States. I personally think that's a bit of selective memory. Polanski arrived on the evening of August 10th and refused to answer reporters' questions as he made his way through customs. One of his friends, Gene Gutowski, read a short statement that condemned the sensationalistic rumors that were being printed about both the murders as well as the marital problems that the Polanskis may or may not have been experiencing. Some statements state that Polanski was interred at Paramount Studios to protect him from both the police as well as the inquisitive reporters. In fact, many say that Polanski was under heavy sedation by a doctor supplied by Paramount Pictures. There are also stories, however, of Polanski immediately going to Cielo Drive and investigating the scene for himself, as well as learning that the films that he and Sharon had taken were removed by police. An interesting sidebar is that a friend of the family called from New York to tell a friend that he knew who had committed the murders. This friend, in turn, contacted LAPD, who offered the man 3 days of amnesty if he would agree to talk to them. This friend agreed and was whisked off to Los Angeles, where he was picked up by 3 police cars and driven to LAPD headquarters. Once in headquarters, this friend told the police that Frykowski had been offered an exclusive dealership in Los Angeles for MDA. Friend also went on to say that a fight had erupted between Frykowski and one of his suppliers who had threatened to cut Frykowski off. Friend also stated that while he did not know the names of the killers, he would be able to pick them out of a police lineup, and that he believed that these men who were from Canada had killed everyone in the house as a result of this falling out. The friend also went on to state that Frykowski kept a diary concerning all of this, which was written in Polish, and that the men's identities were likely to be found inside of these diaries. According to Ed Sanders in his book Sharon a Life, this friend was then escorted around to numerous addresses throughout Los Angeles in an attempt to locate the killers. Although, as we now know, nothing ever came from this particular lead. We are going to leave off the case this week on August 10th. Now we're moving into August 11th. We will be back hopefully next week, where we will continue looking into Charles Manson and his family, and hopefully we will get into the LaBianca murders themselves. Until next time, again, if you enjoy this show, please leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app. Subscribe, share the show on social media. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Until next time, stay morbid.